Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2022 podcast series. This event was proudly supported by Maurice Blackburn Lawyers.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Melbourne Writers Festival. Tonight, we are meeting on the lands of the Kulin Nations, in particular, the Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung people. We pay respects to elders, past and present, and to the elders of all nations across Victoria. By meeting here tonight, we are participating in a tradition of sharing and storytelling that has been going ongoing for many, many thousands of years. Thank you for being here tonight, and thank you, our guests, for also being here tonight. My name is Astrid Edwards, and I am your moderator. I'm going to keep the introductions very short, but starting from the far end of the stage, welcome, Sarah Krasnostein, the author of the quarterly essay, Not Waving, Drowning, Mental Illness and Vulnerability in Australia, as well as, of course, The Trauma Cleaner and The Believer. Next to Sarah, we have Rick Morton, journalist and memoirist, phenomenal memoirist, author of 100 Years of Doit and My Year of Living Vulnerably. Next to Rick, we have Antoinette Latouf, journalist, ambassador for the Gidget Foundation, co-founder of Media Diversity Australia, and author of How to Lose Friends and Influence White People. And we need to be influenced. And next to me and Antoinette, we have Dr. Cammy Murup-Stewart, an Aboriginal woman and lecturer at the Turner Institute of Brain and Mental Health at Monash University. Are we all okay? I'm going to say the answer is no. But to kick off, I'd like to ask each of you your observations of what, if anything, has changed in terms of mental health and well-being during the pandemic. Sarah, you are so far away. Why don't we start with you?
Hello. So, can you hear me okay? All right. I think that one of the positive things, one of very few positive things, but is kind of the idea that mental health, the idea that we live in a unified field, that mental health is inseparable from physical health, education, housing, social interaction, and that people who are already suffering for reasons of being marginalized for a range of other features, we're doing it tougher. So I think that went from being kind of a niche idea to something that could be encountered in the wild on a daily basis. And I think that kind of acceptance of what we know to be an empirical fact is only to everyone's benefit.
I am so impressed you managed to find a positive. Yeah. Well done. Rick.
Yeah, I wasn't. No, I'm going the opposite direction. The pandemic, so this is how it felt to me, but it felt like we were all in Plato's cave, and Plato's like, you got to go out and see the sun, otherwise you don't know what reality is. And for a moment, we're all forced to go outside, we see the sun, it's beautiful, and then they're like, go back to work, everything's fine. And I don't want to go back to the way things were in that sense. I don't want to, you know, work all the time. I want to grow potatoes or some herbs. I just, you know, I want to do something nice with my life that isn't just like this weird rat race. And the moment they flicked the switch and said, actually, reality, you stay home, you don't have to work for a bit.
All the herbs died, right?
Yeah, mine died anyway. I'm like, it's that new Dan virus that got them. And it wasn't me, but but from a privileged position, right, because a lot of people didn't get to stay home and do all of those things. But for the people in the knowledge economy, it felt like a reset, and then they were just like, oh, sorry, you don't get to have, you know, a safety net that you can live on if you're unemployed and all of those things. So it just felt unfair.
Unfair.
I guess I'd add to that, gosh, a few things emerged about mental illness. We know that the rates of mental illness have been increasing rapidly. It can't just be attributed to speaking about it more, screening for it better. I mean, yes, that is a part of it, but we are in a mental health crisis that was exacerbated by the pandemic. On the one hand, more people were talking about it. We heard it routinely at our press conferences. We saw the mental health care plan and sessions double, which was excellent. But we also saw access. It, it shone a spotlight on our issues of access, and even the fact that you might get your piece of paper, and even if you might have answered yesterday that no, you are not okay on Are You Okay Day, and it's like, what now?
Yeah.
I'll see you in 18 months. And so I think it highlighted that. It also did another thing, interestingly. It actually further, I saw in some trenches, further divided people, because what we saw, those who turned, and now there's more and more research to back it, those who turned to conspiracy theories and those who are more likely to be radicalised online, you know, there's more and more data to show that those who have a pre-existing anxiety or mental health condition are more likely. I saw that within my own family. I know we're all related to some people or connected to some people we wish we weren't after we've seen what they've posted. And then I'd be like, I know they're having a really hard time. I know they're unwell, but fuck, they're fucking stupid. And then all of a sudden I'd have like, I get it. Theoretically, I get it that they're unwell, but morally, I don't care. And so I just found this real struggle between knowing that some people were suffering, and it played out in really dangerous ways of misinformation. So, yeah, three very different takes, but we are definitely talking about it more. We don't have the services, and even I think there's a level of empathy loss due to just how polarised we are.
There can be no one take on mental illness. Cammy?
I mean, backing up what everybody else has said, I think there were very different experiences dependent on your personal circumstances. So if you were experiencing isolation beforehand, oh my goodness, Isolation was just compounded. If you had access problems to mental health care before, that was just compounded. If you were lucky enough to live on a quarter acre block with your family, you got to work from home and had a stable job, maybe it didn't impact you that much directly, but you were still impacted by, you know, all of this rhetoric going around in the media, like Antoinette said, all of these conspiracy theories that just sprung up. And yes, yeah, so, some of my family members, it's been a journey to stay in touch with them. But we just now have a very different relationship to before. But I think one of the things, and echoing what Sarah said, is that for Aboriginal community, we don't think of it as mental health or mental illness. It is our well-being is holistic. We consider it in a manner that takes into consideration, you know, our physical health, our access to country, to land, to nature, our relationships with our family and our relationships with our community, our spiritual health, all of those things are intertwined. And something like the pandemic touches on all of those things. And so suddenly we were aware, not just within the Aboriginal community, but discussions started to open up about how actually the environmental factors around us were really, really important to balancing what mental health is, and perhaps we should take some of those things into consideration.
Well said. Everybody here knows we are talking about mental health and illness tonight. So a little trigger warning. No one on stage is going to be offended if anybody takes a break and leaves the room. I just want to put that out there because we may end up talking about trauma and other hard things. I want to ask all of you, and not in order, please just jump in because it's way more exciting if we all just talk, but why is it so hard to address mental health, like as a society? Because we're doing a really bad job. I think everyone agrees that we're doing a bad job. But what's preventing us from making inroads?
Well, I spent 14 months thinking about exactly that, and really ended up, as I always seem to do, in an unexpected place where, you know, I think that the work is going in a particular direction because I've done all the research, and really the material kind of tells you what you need to know if you sit with it for long enough. And I think that the reason, what I was seeing again and again in terms of the stigma against mental health that exists in this country, how it manifests differently, like Cami said, for people who are already the subject of marginalization and discrimination because of Indigenous status or gender or sexuality status, really came back to stigma. And the function of stigma is, of course, maintaining a social order with certain people at the top. And where did it come from? And I think if we're curious, as we are in the private sphere of psychology and psychiatry, with antecedents and patterns of behavior over time and influences, biological and environmental and relational, we can see in Australia that it plays out in a particular way to do with, you know, being all right, being tough, she'll be right, blah, blah. So really, where I came down at the end of the day was that it is tied inextricably with the type of person who is privileged by the settler colonial experience, which was white, male, well into the 1900s, in, you know, a environment where anything that could be perceived as dependency on others or vulnerability or weakness was anathema. And we have more of that inheritance from generations who are not as far removed as we'd like to believe than we often admit. So, yes, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that this is something that, are you okay? It's only other people. And we are very uncomfortable with disclosing our own experiences when we're not having a bad day. And it is, I think, tied very much to that need to appear to be a certain type of person.
One thing that I can't stop thinking about in terms of your quarterly essay is the fact at near the beginning that Victoria's mental institutions are older than the state of Victoria itself, and they were always horrific.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
They were a very bad place to be. Others, what's our problem? Why can't we get together and start making this work?
I can't speak, and I won't purport to have the expertise that someone like Sarah does in terms of some of the broader systemic issues. I can speak to some of my personal experiences. So I am an ambassador for the Gidget Foundation. That's a parents' perinatal mental health organisation after I experienced really debilitating postnatal depression with my second child. For me, navigating it was complex because I had the added layer of intergenerational trauma, having parents who fled war and came as refugees and, like, had legitimate reasons to be sad. And so I really grappled with the, but did you see people be assassinated? Like, why are you crying? And so I felt that because I was so privileged, I did have access to all the things, all the middle-class privileges. I could do yoga and meditate and had all the mindfulness apps. And, you know, I was like, okay, cool, I got this. You know, I can Pilates reformer my way out of this. And then when I found that I couldn't, the shame associated with the fact that I should be better because I had a better quality of life. And since speaking out a lot about that, it's so much more complex when there is lived trauma, when there are cultural barriers. I was told not to go to see a psychiatrist, instead of medication to pray. There are all these things and the cultural expectation of what it is to be a woman in an Arab family. Like, you're meant to like have lots of kids and really like it. And I'm like, but I'm really not liking this small person. And it's a really difficult thing to admit. So for me, it was some of those added cultural layers, got layers of shame. The other work I do in the anti-racism, diversity and inclusion space, there's a lot of racial trauma and microaggressions that people of colour deal with routinely and deal with in everyday life. And speaking about it and advocating against it, it is tiring. And I certainly can't speak for First Nations people. But I can only get a glimpse or a window into that collective trauma and the difficulty navigating everyday life, navigating a pandemic, and navigating constantly being told you're a credit to your race, or with the Media Diversity Australia, our advisory board, a woman on there. She's an amazing, amazing accomplished woman. She's was partner in charge at a big law firm in Sydney, Asian heritage, still gets commended for her command of the English language. And so it's like continually having to prove your Australianness, or continually having to prove your worth, or be an ambassador, or be a good model minority. Those things are tiresome. Those things wear you down above and beyond all the other issues you may be grappling with about mental health. I mean, that's from my perspective, some of the stuff we need to fix to get it right.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's layer upon layer, isn't it? We are tired. Everybody is tired. But you know what your default is? How are you? Oh, I'm well. How are you? Oh, yeah, I'm good. Great. And then you just keep on going on. But everybody has those different layers upon layers upon layers. And when you're experiencing intersectional issues like some of the ones you've just mentioned, Antoinette, navigating healthcare, let alone the mental health care system, is exhausting. It is complex, it's confusing, there are barriers all over the place, and sometimes we're just too tired to even try. So how are we going to bust through those barriers unless you get a little bit of breathing space? I don't know.
And I would add to that, I think, I mean, based purely on the data and the suicide rates among young men, there is a crisis of masculinity mm-hmm. in this country. We know that what it is to be a top bloke probably isn't that top. But there isn't a clear path of how these young men can be. Rick, I don't want to speak for men. I don't often say that.
You have my full permission.
I don't want to speak.
Because I know you needed that.
You know, I don't want to speak for marginalised white men. You know, I think it's really important we hear from them.
I'm embarrassed. I'm blushing.
But I think we also need to acknowledge, when it comes to those suicide rates and when it comes to, I'm okay and being a top bloke, there is... That's where a huge crisis is, and that's where I don't think we're doing well enough.
I gelled really a lot with both Sarah and Antoinette's comments, particularly about the white settler men, because my father was pretty much the caricature of that. It's like Crocodile Dundee if he said the C word, basically. that's how I describe him to people. To give you an indication of how broken perhaps my own brain is by that kind of prism, I legitimately thought this session was meant to be like a funny thing. Like, I was like, I'm going to have so much fun.
Well, I apologise, Rick.
And now I'm like, oh, God, this is actually a serious conversation. Oh, my gosh. Which is on me. This is how I deal, right? I deal by making me and my mum in particular have a really, like, awful sense of humour when it comes to, like, difficult things. And it's just how we get through. But, you know, my dad was this... caricature of a man. He was bitten by, I think it was a brown snake or a king brown, and he was just like, doctors, don't want to see him. I'm like, you've got a problem. At the moment, it's poison coursing through your veins, but later, it's whatever it is that made you say that thing when you are about to die. And it's just, it's particularly the same with mental health, if not worse, because you can't see that injury. And so I grew up in, regional Queensland, where that is the kind of the dominant thinking, certainly in, white culture. We don't have a culture. we've got Cocoa Pops and Tip Top white sliced bread. And it's great. I won't hear a bad word said about it. I grew up around men who are just basically like nothing is ever wrong until literally... in farming communities, they shoot themselves. And it's like you did not see it coming. There was no warning sign. And that's what I've been battling with my whole life, and I still am to it. Like, I still get embarrassed talking. I'm happy to write about it, but to talk about my own mental health challenges in front of anyone is a real, like, barrier to me.
Rick, you've written an entire memoir.
Yeah. It's just like I write about things in there that my mum didn't know about, and I'm like, you can read the manuscript in advance, but I don't want you talking to me about it because that wouldn't be the Morton family way.
Well, that brings me to a question I'd like to ask all of you. In different ways, you have all written and spoken about your experiences, and I'm not asking you to share your experiences now, but I am interested in what was the driver? Like, what was the feeling that you wanted to
note that maybe at one point you weren't okay, and then do the research or share the personal experience. Mm. Antoinette, you're nodding, so I'm going to go to you.
Oh, okay. So it was when I started spiraling. I was about 3 weeks postpartum. So I was 37 weeks pregnant when the symptoms for me started. I had was also covered the Martin Place siege at the time. I don't know why, but the news director was like, maybe it's a good idea to send a heavily pregnant woman just go check out what's going on at the Link Cafe. And so I think that was the beginning of the insomnia and the anxiety. And then over the course of the next 6 weeks, 3 weeks postpartum, I spiraled. I wasn't eating, showering, sleeping. The fear of not appearing okay in front of my aunties and my mother and my mother-in-law, like it being a certain type of mother and a certain type of woman. So I would pretend. And then it was, I mean, I don't want to go into too much detail because this is already a hoot for a Friday night, guys. it was after, when I tried to take my life and my baby's life, but then I stopped and I called a mental health hotline. And the woman on the end of the phone, the one thing she said to me, which will forever stay with me, you did not ask for this and you did not deserve this. And just hearing those words, and then she ensured she stayed on the phone until somebody came and looked after me and looked after my baby. And just being given permission to not be okay, because I felt I didn't have permission because I had so much judgment from people around me. And just generally in my life, I have felt, because I have never seen somebody like me in the public eye, in the media, and so I've always kind of been a first. I was the first to go to university in my extended family. I was the first Arab woman on commercial television. I always felt that, probably unfairly, that I had a responsibility going, okay, if I'm feeling this, I know people with language barriers, with culture, with other cultural barriers, with religious barriers, they're probably not going to have the resources that I have and the voice that I have and the privilege I now have. So I felt that responsibility, rightly or wrongly, I don't know. When I started to write about it, that's when, oh my gosh, so many women who are from all different cultural backgrounds, Vietnamese women who, you know, women from Afghanistan who live with their mother-in-laws, all these people who were struggling so much, but because of cultural expectations were discouraged or were... One person told me, oh, my husband cancelled my appointment to the psychiatrist, told me to go to the mosque. You know, these religious and cultural expectations that could mean that she won't survive or the baby won't survive. So, yeah, rightly or wrongly, I felt I had a responsibility because there was nobody else that understood for me the intersections of those really kind of strict cultural expectations of what it is to be a mother. And then how exactly you navigate that when you don't want to pick up your own child.
Thank you for sharing that again on stage with us tonight. I don't want to pick anyone's names, but what's the imperative of researching and sharing? Like, we can't ride our way out of the mental health crisis in this country, but we can't ignore it either. Cammie, can I ask you, why research?
I think research for me gave me the tools and the language that I didn't have before. And for a young Aboriginal woman who is fair-skinned and who couldn't, again, see much representation, I needed to find something tangible that I could actually say, you know what, no, this isn't just opinion anymore. This is fact. It's right here in front of you. It is a fact that Aboriginal young men have the highest suicide rate in the world. But we're in, like, Australia. What is going on here? And I think for Aboriginal academics, we kind of straddle a really weird line. We can't just be an academic. We're often labelled as activists, you know, because everything we do is political, because it is. Our very being is political in a colonised country. And, I mean, today is a really interesting day. Before I got here, we were I was, you know, scrolling, bad idea, scrolling through Instagram and Twitter and the takes on, you know, what happened this morning and some of the news that's come out can be really challenging. But unless we give that a language and unless we give it a voice, other people are just going to be sitting there feeling confused. And so if I can verbalise and say, you know, here's the research. We live in Australia. Australia is a colonised country. This land has never been ceded. Victoria is the first state in Australia that's even begun discussions for a treaty. And yet today we've got all of these people celebrating the life of a woman who's done such harm to so many people. And if we can't find the language and the terminology and share that with other people are just going to be, you know, watching the news and being like, I don't know why I feel so conflicted right now. Why does this not sit right with me? And it's a hard space to take up to say, you know what, I don't agree with some of this that's going on. And I know that other people out there also don't agree. So maybe if I have the energy and if I have the courage and if I have the support to say something, maybe that's my responsibility. Maybe that's where I need to speak up a little bit.
Can I just add to Cammie's comment? The Batuta Advocate has the best take so far, the best coverage. I highly recommend. Comprehensive.
Very good.
Also with research, I mean, if we can't quantify the scale of the problem and we can't look at evidence-based solutions either here or abroad, because for some reason Scandinavians always get shit right. Like, you know, damn you tall, blonde, amazing people.
I think it's the lack of sun half the year. They've got to read a lot.
There's just so much in their social welfare and social and their responses. But just to go, okay, like to be able to quantify and have that awful data about, Indigenous young men most likely to take their lives, like we need to have those uncomfortable, awful, confronting statistics so we can somehow figure a way out.
But like also, I'm not even...
No,
I love you.
No, I have a second what you say. I was just going to say that I think that... I've totally forgot. No. That
my superpower, I hold someone's hand, memory's gone.
Come for the love. And what I think is so profound, that thread between what Antoinette and Cammie have just been saying, is that in a sense we're all writing ourselves into a place that doesn't exist in public, and it's highly uncomfortable. And whenever I come to a place where it should happen, I never want to do it. It's never easier, even on the page, even in private, even before I hand anything in. I don't like doing it. But I am called or compelled to do it because if nothing changes, nothing changes. And so on top of, you know, the trauma of what each of us has experienced, the compounding trauma of having to pretend something is otherwise, and we know, and I just kind of spruik my Twitter, but I ahead of the session I have tomorrow with Anita Hill, tweeted an article on kind of groupthink and abuse disclosure, and how the knee-jerk reaction, because of the way group psychology works, when someone discloses an experience of abuse, sexual or otherwise, is a discrediting reaction. It's kind of a reflexive disbelief because we are so comfortable, even if it's an uncomfortable comfortableness with what is. And that's the social hierarchy at work. It's clear, it's unfair, but at least it's predictable and we all know what's expected. And when we have somebody that's saying, you know what, I'm not going to suffer this and pretend that everything is okay, things can't change without it. Mm-hmm. So whenever I feel kind of this shame, which is never my shame, it's others' shame, I force myself to go through it with the protection of numerous drafts and, you know, editorial input and all the rest. But ultimately what I'm doing is I'm putting on paper something that normalizes a universal human experience. Poor mental health is as frequent as poor physical health, because one day, and I'm sure they will never care, but if my children read my work one day, I am there doing it in a way that makes it okay for them
as, you know, in future two young men, to say, I am not okay today. They'll have a precedent for it. So, yes, I think in an answer to everyone who says that first person is narcissistic, at least we don't pretend to have the all-seeing eye of God with the impartial, emotionless, passive voice.
I was just going to say before that the way I think about it, because I agree with 100%, and I don't want to restate it, but like if you've got a mental illness or a physiological problem with your brain, like trauma, you've got to know what you're fighting. And it's like if you're like kind of running through the forest and something's attacking you and chasing you and like, I don't know, eating someone from your party every other day and you're like, what the fuck's going on? And then on like the seventh day, it's like, holy shit, it's a tiger and it comes out of the grass. And you're like, now I know how to fight the tiger. I might still get eaten by it because I'm a human being, but I know it's a tiger. I know, you know, what it's capable of. I know it's got claws and teeth. All of these things allow you to anticipate how this thing might actually affect you. And I just, you know, I found the moment that I found a language for my childhood experiences, it was like, you know, the end of that movie Memento, where like everything started falling into peace. I was like, holy shit, this makes so much sense now. And, you know, I'm still dealing with it, but I'm dealing with it in a much more capable manner than I was before, which was not. I wasn't dealing with it well before.
I'd like to ask you about shame and stigma. You've already said the word shame several times, Sarah, and Antoinette, you brought up stigma. Both are so intertwined with the experience of mental health and mental ill health internally and, you know, what professions and society can dump on someone and make it all worse. How do we, I mean, talking about it helps, but I want to go beyond talking about it. Like, what does it take to break the stigma and to help someone not feel shame?
I mean, let's voice it. One of the things, I did my master's thesis on shame and the welfare system, not in Australia. I did this in, like, the idea of community development projects. But then it got me thinking about my experience, you know, as an undergraduate uni student lining up, because back then you had to line up at Centrelink, and the idea, the feeling that you had standing in a line with, like, security guards all around you and waiting to talk to somebody to receive a little bit of money so that you can, you know, buy your next meal. Holy moly, you felt crap by the end. So you get up there and you talk to somebody and they're just like, chick, 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 chick. If somebody had said to me, you know, I know today's a bit shit, here you go, I'm going to try and help you out. This system doesn't work well for everybody, but let's work through this. It's okay to be here and do that. This is what the welfare system is for. This is what the mental health care system is for. If somebody actually spoke those words, you're already breaking down that barrier.
Yeah, I remember when I was, it's only a few years ago actually, I was having this chat with this straight white man friend of mine, who's a really good mate of mine called Eric. I won't embarrass him any further than that, with a C, E-R-I-C. And, like, I mean, by his own admission, he's got no experience of any of these things. He's like, he's always just been one of those annoyingly well-adjusted people. Like, you get one every 100,000. Yeah, you want to push him down the stairs. But I was in a really bad place. I was in a dark, dark place. And, you know, he was like, I don't know. He's like, I don't know what to say to you, buddy, except that, you know, you keep saying that you think you're weak and that you think that, you know, why does this keep happening to you? Like, is maybe the problem's you? He's like, I don't think any of those things. He's like, I think you're the strongest person I've ever met. And you know what? It made me feel really good. Yeah, because I was like, I am strong.
Yeah. Like, it's reframing what we applaud and see as strong.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that we're still here makes us strong. Yeah. Maybe not physically, but I'm working on that too.
But I think also that points towards, you know, it's such an early and vulnerable stage of development and universal tendency. And we see it with child psychology that, you know, in an unsafe system, children will blame themselves because that's a survival adaptation. And I think in a sense, if we don't become curious about all of our kind of seething pain. We continue to do that, again, because we want our society to be normal and trustworthy and good and capable of being, you know, understood and predictable and certain. And we want to make that happen, we'll have to blame ourselves for having these unjust, seemingly unjust or unreasonable reactions. And there's a whole range of language for that. Mm. And so little language for, it's not your fault. Mm. You've done a good job. You had to get out of the system. You had to call for help. You have all of those responses that somebody trained in a proper, you know, listening response will be able to give you, but so few people will offer. We are stuck in it. You see it in the media, you see it in the culture at large, you see it in politics. It is easier to pretend that there's not a problem. And one of the most distressing things I read in the research for the quarterly essay, and, you know, no, not to take the shine off the actual research report itself, which was wonderfully done and very, you know, comprehensive, but the Productivity Commission's report into mental illness, mental health in Australia, globally conceived the notion that the call for change has to be framed in economic terms because of literal cost per life lost, mm-hmm. hints to, we haven't even begun to solve this problem, because in an economic framework where life has value because it, you know, can promote more capital, those are the conditions which are causing us to continue to feel shame that we're not producing more, that we're not valuable, that we're overly dependent on others and all the rest of it. So again, in a unified field, everything has to change, but it kind of starts at a very personal level.
And I do.
Can I just really quickly point out that this is my favourite thing in the world to mention all the time. The Productivity Commission in that report very specifically called out income support and the employment services system in this country, which basically forces people in poverty to run on a treadmill to get their treats. And it's, you know, if the Productivity Commission can say it, then, you know, everyone else can too.
As we're obviously coming out of the pandemic, or it's endemic or whatever, people's capacity to... people who'd never experienced any mental health... a lot of people struggled for the first time. People are like, I'm a pretty well-adjusted thing, but I'm sick of making sourdough. I fucking feel shit, you know? And so everybody kind of was like, yeah, and I'm sick of your pictures of sourdough bread too. Like, stop it.
I killed my sourdough starter. Yeah,
and so there was this sort of collective... We're in it together. We kind of all got it. We understood why you were feeling bad, right? But it's when there's no explanation for why you are the way you are. And I think that's what I fear. So we're going to come out of this... we are emerging out of this. My greatest struggle was that I could tick every box. I had everything, which meant I should be okay, and I wasn't. That's one point I want to make. So I think people's bandwidth to care is going to lessen, because it's like, oh, no, but, like, didn't you just come back from Bali? but also we talk a lot about depression and anxiety, which I know can be absolutely debilitating and acute, because I have experienced it. But we have some of the other less sexy forms of mental illness that we don't talk about that are so much more acute, where we have almost, like, in New South Wales, for example, I was luckily, because I'm Lebanese and I have like 7,000 relatives, I had heaps of people to look after me when I was really unwell. I was never left alone. If I didn't have someone to look after me the whole time, the only other alternative was for me to go to a private mental health facility for mum and bub. There isn't a public one in New South Wales. Mm. You have to buy your way in. And I was fortunate enough to have my family with me. There are so many people who either end up in jail or harm because there is nowhere. There are a couple of times where I took myself to hospital in the middle of the night because I just knew that I was a danger to myself. And I would wait in the waiting room for hours and hours and get turned away. And so then I just think we have a problem with the really acute care that needs immediate attention. People, where do they go? They end up dead, or they end up in jail.
I spend $350 a month on top-tier private health cover for the potential that I might need a private psychiatric instay.
Yeah.
I've needed it in the past when I didn't have private health and I just couldn't do it. And I was like a danger to myself, and now I just spend a fortune on this thing that I probably still
need.
And
that's a privilege to be able to. How many people cannot?
I'm so, like, even during when I was the worst parts of my, what I call my 5-year mental breakdown, you know, I was working as a journalist. I was on almost 6 figures, living in Sydney, granted, and still trying to look after my mum. And I was barely able to afford, in fact, I couldn't afford to see the psychologist as often as I wanted to because it was costing me $1,000 a month.
Money is a barrier, and money can help alleviate some things, but not everything. Mm. I want to ask all of you what happens when the services or the system itself isn't actually safe. The carceral system isn't always safe. The health profession, the health system is not safe, not just necessarily in the attempt to find acute care, but there is bias against certain conditions and diseases and diagnoses, in addition to all of the other discrimination that a person might face. Mm. How can we start to unpick and wind back the danger in the system itself, even though we need the system to work for us?
My PhD research spoke to young Aboriginal people in Naam here in Melbourne about their experiences with wellbeing and culture. And one of the stories that really stuck with me that I just can't get out of my head. She's a young woman in her early 20s. She was here in Melbourne to study, so she was away from family. She was on a country different to her own traditional country. She was experiencing pretty bad mental health symptoms, and she was able to recognise it. She had friends that advocated for her to go and see somebody, and she was able to access a university-provided support system, so she could go and see a psychologist, counsellor, psychologist, I can't remember. She filled in her intake form, ticked the I'm Aboriginal box, went in and met with this therapist for the first time, and one of the first things the therapist asked, you know, going through the form, I think you ticked this box wrong. Let me just take that off for you. And it was on her, who's already feeling this shame and this overwhelming burden. She's like, actually, no, I'm Aboriginal. And then further on in the discussion, she was kind of, you know, recounting some of her personal history and shared that when she was young, her mum had left the family for a short period of time. The therapist asked her, you know, where did she go? And she's like, I don't know. I'm not sure what happened. And the therapist was like, oh, she must have just gone walkabout, right? And the assumptions that were placed on this young girl, the judgment that she felt, and the impetus on her to explain her way out of that situation and educate somebody that should have known better, meant that she got up and said, I'm sorry, I can't be here today, and she never went back. I was the next person that she spoke to about her mental health problems, and it was only because, you know, she came to do a research project. This was months and months and months later, and a few simple lines by somebody that caused a feeling of judgment by people who really, really should know better. You know what? That's not okay. And I think it's not just mental health practitioners. The entire healthcare system really needs to have a look at the kinds of judgment and training. And, you know, you've got this idea that black people feel less pain, or there's this legacy of women don't need pain medication, or chronic illness is all in your head, right? What a way to stigmatise all of these things. I think the healthcare system really needs to do some serious work on becoming person-centred. This needs to be about people and people's experience, not just about, you know, a checkbox diagnosis. I think there's an awful, awful long way to go.
I think that, just if I could add, I mean, that is what I learned, the importance of that sort of culturally safe care and the egregious gap we have in its provision. And I think, you know, a really practical place to start is increasing funding in all areas of the health system to provide culturally safe care for people that need it. And then this starts with the simple kind of ability to throw money at this problem, take it out of the hundreds of asylum seekers that are still on Nauru or our submarines or what have you. But, you know, it starts with teacher training,
so that they can identify and have skills with managing students' distress instead of punishing it. It starts with injecting huge amounts of money into safe housing, supporting single parents who are most often female. One of the most distressing interviews I did for the essay was with a fairly experienced police officer who said that, you know, this problem, the mental health crisis, presents to him as a domestic violence call out every 10 to 12 minutes. Domestic violence every 5 to 6 minutes.
Yeah, that's right.
And the mental health call out every 10 to 12 minutes. So what we think of as just, you know, your catch-all vanilla mental health call out is actually, we separate out domestic mm-hmm. violence. So all of these are areas that can't be solved, you know, as a matter of first principles with more money, but it is absolutely necessary, and it was necessary 20 years ago. So that's where it would start. And that, you know, with giving a bed to everyone who needs a bed in acute care, not making people in crisis who are often trauma survivors sleep in public waiting rooms trying to get a bed. And then that buys a little time to start looking at how we're crafting policies and practices, not just in institutions, but the ways in which in our daily life and our workplaces and our newspapers and our interactions with family and friends, all the ways in which we could do better at normalizing the fact that this is universal, so prevalent that it's universal, and not a moral issue, not a moral failure. So
sometimes I feel like, as you're probably all aware, yesterday was Are You Okay Day. And for a podcast that I'm a part of, they said, oh, you know, can you do a little video as our host and talk about it? And I did. And then afterwards, I immediately regretted it because I thought, yes, I'm all for talking and asking people, are you okay? But I felt that it was a little bit disingenuous, or it was just like, okay, so people are going to say that they're not okay, but I can't be confident they have somewhere to go or something, or the next step, or that they're going to be cared for. So I'm all for these conversations, and we're getting better at having these conversations, and we need young men to have these conversations. But then I just feel, but where are the conversations going? Where are we directing them? Are there the services for these people to get help? There are so many structural issues that we need to, I'm not saying don't ask if people are okay, but I was very conscious of the fact that if they are not, I'm like, all right.
Well, you just ask it and then very quickly go, good chat.
How's the sourdough? Yeah. You know, any more pictures of sourdough? You know, and I was really aware of that and really saddened by that. And then I was starting to question my role in doing advocacy and ambassador work for mental health services, because it is important to talk. But more crucially, it's important to act, and crucially, it's important to have services and to address the structural issues in workplaces, in hospitals, the cultural biases. There's so much work to be done that I almost felt like I don't know if I want to ask, are you okay?
Every time I write about this, I talk to like mental health professionals, and they're always like, we've done awareness. People are aware.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like we've had like 5, 6, national mental health plans and suicide prevention awareness campaigns, which is something the federal government does. Or they open a new Headspace, which is something that the, and there's nothing wrong with Headspace on its own, but it's not enough. And it's what the federal government in particular does every time they want to be seen to be doing something that doesn't cost any money and doesn't actually do anything. The biggest problem for me has been like the primary, the interface. You go to a GP, and I'd have nothing against GPs, but I've never had a good one. I don't think it's their fault. I think it is the fault of the system. But one of the keenest moments that I felt like I was going to kill myself was when I went to go get my national mental health care plan, whatever the fuck they call it now. This has been recorded, by the way. It's going to be so many bleeps on the ABC. I'm so sorry. Between me and Antoinette. Yeah.
Potty mouth journos.
I told the reception, it was a walk-in clinic because it was a bulk build and I didn't have any money, and they refer me up, and I go to a GP who's not my normal GP, who wasn't I didn't even have a normal GP, but she was, I sort of went to her all the time. And they sent me to this other bloke. I get up there and then he finds out that I want a mental health care plan. That takes 15 minutes as opposed to 5, and he loses it.
He's like, would you like antibiotics instead?
Yeah. He's like, this is my lunch break and like I've got patients. He's like, they didn't tell me that. Like, you need to leave. Oh. And like, he made me leave.
I'm so sorry you had that experience, right?
And I just wanted to walk out into traffic, like genuinely, because I was like at my lowest ebb. And it's like that's the thing that pushes you over, right? Mm. That one little encounter. And then I had another GP tell me I need to watch RuPaul's Drag Race, not as a, like a friendly recommendation, but as a way to be like, maybe you'd be okay with being gay if you saw that show. Thank you. That's basically what I said. I said, are you fucking kidding me?
Completely unhelpful.
I think this idea that this is not just kind of a soft skill, this is part of clinical treatment that can make or break.
And that very first interaction is everything, can be everything.
I was thinking of, and you know, the data is obviously that we have left our GPs, of whom were already not enough, and our, you know, paramedics and the police to be not just the front line of mental health care provision in this country, but often the entirety. And, you know, they are overwhelmed. I had the experience. I gave birth at the very start, the first week of the first lockdown, which I don't recommend for anyone. not because of the pandemic, but had to shortly after go into a treatment for complex PTSD that is often administered on an inpatient basis. But because we didn't know much about COVID and it was all very scary and blah, 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 I got, you know, a psychologist who was willing to do it on an outpatient basis. But again, without kind of the ability to discern between practitioners and afford different practitioners to get into them in the first place. I'm telling you this because my consult with the GP, in order to get my own mental health care plan or whatever, was so cursory. I was, you know, trying to rush through it so I could get back to this very wonderful psychologist who I was lucky enough to get on her books. It was a formality, and I, you know, had a community around me, and I was going to be fine in their care. But this GP knew none of that. And it occurred to me on that phone call, because it was a telehealth, not even a visual one, how easy it would be to say, yeah, I'm okay. And then you can lose a life. That's the difference between being okay and not. So, you know, not any comment on GPs who do a huge amount of good work, but when we overwhelm them to put a Band-Aid on a problem that requires surgery.
You can't do their job under these circumstances.
Yeah. This is really reactionary, isn't it, right? People are already coming with serious problems, and we talk about prevention. We have all of these suicide prevention plans. Suicide prevention? Why are we waiting until we're at that kind of a crisis point? I think underlying we've got a dodgy foundation. We've got a dodgy foundation. We're not doing enough to promote wellness rather than treat mental illness. I think we need to take a step back and say, I mean, you know, you've heard the talk about quiet quitting. You know, let's talk around the issue for a little bit. Quiet quitting. It's burnout. People are burnt out, and because of this idea of capitalism that says, you know, productivity equals value. If you can't produce, if you can't function and at this level that is acceptable to capitalism, then you have no value. And if you have no value, where do you sit? What do you do? What's your purpose? If we can't actually constructively look at the foundational problems that we've got going on, then we can't tackle prevention. And if we can't tackle prevention, we're just going to keep on hitting these crisis points where GPs are overwhelmed, where we're calling the police because somebody's feeling suicidal. That is not the cop's job. And they're not trained for it.
It's not going to end well.
No. It's not going
to end well. And I almost feel, I mean, thank you for all of your viewpoints, and I almost feel like I'm in defence of GPs. I have a really good GP, and I know I'm super fortunate. I'm not telling anybody his name or the other.
This is what I've come to, though. Yeah. It's like, he's mine.
Yeah, well, I'm like, my GP is really good. Like, who is he? Oh, he's on holidays.
Yeah.
When he's coming back.
He goes to another school. You probably never met him.
But he was, I just know it's so rare that the way he cared
you know, cared for me. In short, I got on someone's books, the psychiatrist's books, within 3 days because I just knew I couldn't make it if it was any longer than that. Called me. I don't know many GPs who call and check because he just knew that day I wasn't well. Anyway, I just wanted to shout out that, yes, they are overworked. Yes, there are structural issues. No, I will not tell you who my GP is.
Sarah and I are going to tailgate you to your GP.
But just quickly, sorry, I just wanted to quickly add that, you know, when we talk about adequately funding housing and adequately funding our schools, that's suicide prevention. Mm-hmm. When we talk about, you know, and they're gone now, but we had a government that was funding the Productivity Commission inquiry on the one hand and the stigma reduction strategy on the other, and taking that empirical evidence from their own committees that was unequivocally saying that stigma is driving higher suicide rates in Indigenous kids and trans kids, and then passing something like the religious discrimination bill. But the other hand, that getting rid of that conduct, standing up and calling it out, that's suicide prevention. So it's not only, you know, locating it with better primary care. All of these aspects are primary care.
And just really quickly, I've written a double-page spread on housing and homelessness in the Saturday paper tomorrow that goes to all of those issues.
I refer you to the Saturday paper.
Everyone, read Rick Morton tomorrow. I'm going to intervene here and actually add teachers to the list that everybody has met. Mm-hmm. Teachers are also part of frontline care and mental health. We are almost out of time. We have a few minutes left. I'd like to ask each of you, just for your final thoughts, what would you like those who are here with us tonight to remember? Cammy, you start.
I think there is an awful lot that we can learn from First Nations people about well-being, being holistic. If we're talking about prevention, one of the young fellows said to me, you know, the way we could fix the system is add being able to go back to country to Medicare rebates. Like, let's start to think outside the box a little bit from this neoliberal Western idea of what mental illness is, what mental health is, what health is. Let's start to consider these other aspects that can actually work towards building up prevention strategies. Let's start to consider that, you know, we need to go and spend time with nature. We need time with family. We don't need to work 9 to 5, 5 days a week. And I mean, most people don't even do that. Like, we're stretching it out. Maybe we need to consider the value of community. And I think COVID really brought that out. At the time, I was living in, you know, like uber suburbia. and I loved it because every day everybody was out taking a walk. You know, you're 2 hours, you get to go out for a walk. We met so many people, and I genuinely feel a sense of loss having moved from there because community was built up. We started to break down those isolation barriers. We started to reassess what our priorities were, and they were different to the way we had been living.
Can I go last? I just want to be like really profound.
I love the honesty. That means you're up next, Rick. Yeah.
I mean,
you can be as well.
I remember interviewing you and be like, oh, we should have some hope, right? We should try and inject some hope somewhere. And there's not a lot going around, but if there is, we should mine it. Like, like the Gina Reinhardt of hope. But if you're in, and I don't want to like go on and on and on about it, but this is the stuff that matters, right? Like, if like financial stress isn't going to necessarily create a mental health problem for you, but you will not get better with existing mental health problems if you are in financial stress. It cannot be done. The reason that I'm sitting here today in relative good mental health, and I've had a shit fucking year, believe me, I broke my glasses today. This is not the worst thing that's happened to me, but I can't see anyone and I'm feeling very agitated about it. But the reason I'm here today is not because I was able to get all of the treatment that I ever needed. It's because I started having a little bit of extra money because my books were published, and it was in addition to my income, and I'm working a lot, but it's like that little bit of extra money. I work from home now. I essentially work for myself even though I have a full-time job. And it's time and money. It's time and money. That's all it's ever been. And we've got a government successively over many years that refuses to look at people who are living in poverty and say, maybe we could actually do something about suicide. They'll attend the launch of the report, but they won't do anything about poverty. Profound.
I second all of that. I just ibid. No. I would say that there is no us in them when it comes to mental illness, and that if you find yourself in a position on one side of that stigma, I guess on the higher, the luckier side of that us-them binary, and you stay quiet, keep in mind that that power dynamic could shift at any moment onto a totally different hook to hang it on. You know, it could be sexuality, it could be gender, it could be anything. It shifts all the time because it's not about any of these reasons. It's about the power, exercise of power itself. And if you don't say something or act in a way to kind of neutralize it or negate it or call it out, it will still exist in the water and it will come back one day to devour you. So it behooves us all not to play along and to speak truth to power, which can be done in very tiny ways all the time. And that's how we make the world a better place. And I would also just say one other thing. If you find someone that shames you or makes you feel unsafe when you're seeking care or treatment or support, keep going, because there are safe people out there. Just really keep going.
Here's my moment.
Profound.
you've set yourself up.
As someone who, you know, I spend a lot of time advocating for minorities, I spend a lot of time being an anti-racism advocate, speaking about experiences as a woman of colour. But I guess I want to wrap up. My biggest concern is young men and the crisis we have in young white men who are turning to figures online, who are trying to find their space, who are trying to find their voice. And I could make a whole lot of jokes about, you know, let's make space for white men. But I honestly do fear for the crisis in masculinity that we have. We need to find a way to celebrate masculinity where masculinity isn't just associated with toxicity. We need to engage young men. The ASIO's spending more time on the growing far-right extremism of, you know, young men radicalised online aged between 16 to 21. I fear the danger they are to themselves, the danger they are to society. I don't have those issues. I'm all for talking about the intersections, the other intersections, and we know how marginalised and the greater barriers that are faced by people who are First Nations or queer or live with a disability. But I honestly think something that is a national urgency and something we don't talk enough about, and perhaps we need to have those conversations where we're at a personal level. We need to ask that who our role models are for these people. We need to put more pressure on our policymakers and our politicians, because I fear what sort of society we have and what danger they can inflict on themselves and others if we don't create, you know, a safer, wholer path for them.
I'd like to see a safe space for all of us. Thank you so much, Sarah, Rick, Antoinette, and Cami. Can we have a round of applause? And thank you for all being here tonight.
Thanks for listening. This series was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which we work. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders past and present. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.